Alice Walker is my age. She was born in 1944. She's a black writer, American writer, and she writes a lot of poetry that I love. I actually have one of her poems here that I might read later, too. But her short stories are delightful, and they're layered. So there's a lot of things going on in them. Hi, Sally. And this one in particular is, I think, beautifully written, and so it's fun for me to read. So I will at least enjoy that process. I don't have my glasses with me, so I can't guarantee that I'll get every word right. I'll do my best. They probably wouldn't do the same, would they? But if anybody would like a copy of it, I have a couple extra copies here. Well, if you need to look at it, or maybe later you'll want to look at it. I chose the story partly during this week because it is about our inheritance. It's about what we do with what we've been given as a culture or as a family. I, for example, am Norwegian and Lutheran, and so I've been given a lot of things just because I'm Norwegian and Lutheran that affect the way I operate in the world and affect how I think about things and affect who I am. And I think, everybody has a culture that they've inherited, and you sort of have to sort through, for example, how much of it you're going to transmit to your children. Are you going to make lutefisk and lefse every Christmas? From scratch, or are you going to go on to better things? You know, you're going to make them eat that lutefisk every Christmas Eve. And these days in America, our inheritance or our sort of historical culture that we've come from, the stuff that wherever our parents came from, they brought with them, is in a kind of revival. Every small town in America now has a craft shop with quilted stuff in it. That sort of country that country is in, whatever that means. And that's, I think, an attempt to get back to our roots, whatever our roots are. And this story is really about that kind of quest in one family, a black family in the South. I think I'll read it and then we can talk about it. It's a wonderful, I just love the story.
What's the name of it?
It's called Everyday Use, by Alice Walker. And the subtitle is For Your Grandmama. I will wait for her in the yard that Maggie and I made so clean and wavy yesterday afternoon. A yard like this is more comfortable than most people know. It's not just a yard. It's like an extended living room. When the hard clay is swept clean as a floor and the fine sand around the edges lined with tiny irregular grooves, anyone can come and sit and look up into the elm tree and wait for the breezes that never come inside the house. Maggie will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. She thinks her sister has held life always in the palm of one hand, that no is a word the world never learned to say to her. You've no doubt seen those TV shows where the child who has made it is confronted, as a surprise, by her own mother and father tottering in weakly from backstage. A pleasant surprise, of course. What would they do if parent and child came on the show only to curse out and insult each other? On TV, mother and child embrace and smile into each other's faces. Sometimes the mother and father weep. The child wraps them in her arms and leans across the table to tell how she would not have made it without their help. I have seen these programs. Sometimes I dream a dream in which Dee and I are suddenly brought together on a TV program of this sort. Out of a dark and soft-seated limousine, I am ushered into a bright room filled with many people. There, I meet a smiling, gray, sporty man like Johnny Carson, who shakes my hand and tells me what a fine girl I have. Then we are on stage, and Dee is embracing me with tears in her eyes. She pins on my dress a large orchid, even though she has told me once that she thinks orchids are tacky flowers. In real life, I am a large, big-boned woman with rough, man-working hands. In the winter, I wear flannel nightgowns to bed and overalls during the day. I can kill and clean a hog as mercilessly as a man. My fat keeps me hot in zero weather. I can work outside all day, breaking ice to get water for washing. I can eat pork liver cooked over the open fire minutes after it comes steaming from the hog. One winter, I knocked a bull calf straight in the brain between the eyes with a sledgehammer and had the meat hung up to chill before nightfall. But of course, all this does not show on television. I am the way my daughter would want me to be, 100 pounds lighter, my skin like an uncooked barley pancake. My hair glistens in the hot, bright lights. Johnny Carson has much to do to keep up with my quick wit and witty tongue. But that is a mistake. I know, even before I wake up. Whoever knew a Johnson with a quick tongue? Who can even imagine me looking a strange white man in the eye? It seems to me I have talked to them always with 1 foot raised in flight, with my head turned in whichever way is farthest from them. Dee, though, she would always look anyone in the eye. Hesitation was no part of her nature. "How do I look, Mama?" Maggie says, showing just enough of her thin body, enveloped in pink skirt and red blouse, to let me know she's there, almost hidden by the door. "Come out into the yard," I say. Have you ever seen a lame animal, perhaps a dog run over by some careless person rich enough to own a car, slide up to someone who is ignorant enough to be kind to him? That is the way my Maggie walks. She has been like this, chin on chest, eyes on ground, feet in shuffle, ever since the fire that burned the other house to the ground. Dee is lighter than Maggie, with nicer hair and a fuller figure. She is a woman now, though I sometimes forget. How long ago was it that the other house burned? 10, 12 years? Sometimes I can still hear the flames and feel Maggie's arms sticking to me, her hair smoking and her dress falling off her in little black papery flakes. Her eyes seemed stretched open, blazed open by the flames reflected in them. And Dee, I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree she used to dig gum out of, a look of concentration on her face as she watched the last dingy gray board of the house fall in toward the red-hot brick chimney. Why don't you do a dance around the ashes? I'd wanted to ask her. She had hated the house that much. I used to think she hated Maggie, too, but that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us two, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with the serious way she read, and shove us away just at the moment, like dimwits, we seemed about to understand. Dee wanted nice things. A yellow organdy dress to wear to her graduation from high school, black pumps to match a green suit she'd made from an old suit somebody gave me. She was determined to stare down any disaster in her efforts. Her eyelids would not flicker for a minute at a time. Often I fought off the temptation to shake her. At 16, she had a style of her own, and she knew what style was. I never had an education myself. After second grade, the school was closed down. Don't ask me why. In 1927, colored asked fewer questions than they do now. Sometimes Maggie reads to me. She stumbles along good-naturedly, but she can't see well. She knows she is not bright. Good looks, like good looks and money, quickness passed her by. She will marry John Thomas, who has mossy teeth in an earnest face. And then I'll be free to sit here and, I guess, just sing church songs to myself. Although I never was a good singer. Never could carry a tune. I was always better at a man's job. I used to love to milk till I was hooked in the side in 49. Cows are soothing and slow and don't bother you unless you try to milk them the wrong way. I have deliberately turned my back on the house. It is three rooms, just like the one that burned, except the roof is tin. They don't make shingle roofs anymore. There are no real windows, just some holes cut in the sides like the portholes in a ship, but not round and not square, with rawhide holding the shutters up on the outside. This house is in a pasture, too, like the other one. No doubt when Dee sees it, she will want to tear it down. She wrote me once that no matter where we, quote, chose to live, she will manage to come see us, but she will never bring her friends. Maggie and I thought about this, and Maggie asked me, Mama, when did Dee ever have any friends? She had a few furtive boys in pink shirts hanging about on wash day after school, nervous girls who never laughed. Impressed with her, they worshipped the well-turned phrase, the cute shape, the scalding humor that erupted like bubbles in lye. She read to them. When she was courting Jimmy T, she didn't have much time to pay to us, but turned all of her fault-finding power on him. He flew to marry a cheap girl from a family of ignorant, flashy people. She hardly had time to recompose herself. When she comes, I will meet... But there they are. Maggie attempts to make a dash for the house in her shuffling way, but I stay her with my hand. Come back here, I say. And she stops and tries to dig a well in the sand with her toe. It is hard to see them clearly through the strong sun. But even the first glimpse of leg out of the car tells me it is Dee. Her feet were always neat-looking, as if God himself had shaped them with a certain style. From the other side of the car comes a short, stocky man. Hair is all over his head, a foot long, and hanging from his chin like a kinky mule tail. I hear Maggie suck in her breath. Is what it sounds like. Like when you see the wriggling end of a snake just in front of your foot on the road. Dee next, a dress down to the ground in this hot weather, a dress so loud it hurts my eyes. There are yellows and oranges enough to throw back the light of the sun. I feel my whole face warming from the heat waves it throws out. Earrings gold, too, and hanging down to her shoulders. Bracelets dangling and making noises when she moves her arm up to shake the folds of the dress out of her armpits. The dress is loose and flows as she walks, and as she walks closer, I like it. I hear Maggie go, again. It is her sister's hair. It stands straight up like the wool on a sheep. It is black as night, and around the edges are two long pigtails that rope around like small lizards disappearing behind her ears. Wa suzo tieno, she says, coming on in that gliding way the dress makes her move. The short, stocky fellow with the hair to his navel is all grinning, and he follows up with, Assalamu alaikum, my mother and sister. He moves to hug Maggie, but she falls back, right up against the back of my chair. I feel her trembling there, and when I look up, I see the perspiration falling off her chin. Don't get up, says Dee. Since I am stout, it takes something of a push. You can see me trying to move a second or two before I make it. She turns, showing white heels through her sandals, and goes back to the car. Out she peeks next with a Polaroid. She stoops down quickly and lines up picture after picture of me sitting there in front of the house with Maggie cowering behind me. She never takes a shot without making sure the house is included. When a cow comes nibbling around the edge of the yard, she snaps it and me and Maggie and the house. Then she puts the Polaroid back in the car, in the back seat of the car, and comes up and kisses me on the forehead. Meanwhile, Assalamu Alaikum is going through the motions with Maggie's hand. Maggie's hand is as limp as a fish and probably as cold despite the sweat, and she keeps trying to pull it back. It looks like Assalamu Alaikum wants to shake hands but wants to do it fancy. Or maybe he doesn't know how people shake hands. Anyhow, he soon gives up on Maggie. Well, I say, D. No, Mama, she says, not D. Wangaroo, Lee, Wanika, Ki, Manjo. What happened to D? I wanted to know. She's dead, Wangaroo said. I couldn't bear it anymore, being named after the people who oppress me. You know as well as me that you was named after your Aunt Dicey, I said. Dicey is my sister. She named D. We called her Big D after D was born. But who was she named after, asked Wangaroo. I guess after Grandma D, I said. And who was she named after, asked Wangaroo. Her mother, I said, and saw Wangaroo was getting tired. That's about as far back as I can trace it, I said, though in fact I probably could have carried it back beyond the Civil War through the branches. Well, said Assalamu Alaikum, there you are. Ugh, I heard Maggie say. There I was not, I said, before Dicey cropped up in our family, so why should I try to trace it that far back? He just stood there grinning, looking down on me like somebody inspecting a Model A car. Every once in a while, he and Wangaroo sent eye signals over my head. How do you pronounce this name? I asked. You don't have to call me by it if you don't want to, said Wangaroo. Why shouldn't I? I asked. If that's what you want us to call you, we'll call you. I know it might sound awkward at first, said Wangaroo. I'll get used to it, I said. Ream it out again. Well, as soon as we got the name out of the way, Assalamu Alaikum had a name twice as long and three times as hard. Remember, Assalamu Alaikum was just what he said in greeting, so she's just labeled him that.
Oh, okay.
She doesn't know what it is. His name is twice as long and three times as hard. After I tripped over it a time, two or three times, he told me to just call him Hakim a Barber.
Oh.
I wanted to ask him, was he a barber, but I didn't really think he was, so I didn't ask. You must belong to those beef cattle people down the road, I said. They say Assalamu Alaikum when they meet you, too, but they didn't shake hands. Always too busy, feeding the cattle, fixing the fences, putting up salt lick shelters, throwing down hay. When the white folk poisoned some of the herd, the men stayed up all night with rifles in their hands. I walked a mile and a half just to see the sight. Hakima Barber said, I accept some of their doctrines, but farming and raising cattle is not my style. They didn't tell me, and I didn't ask, whether Wangaroo, parenthesis D, had really gone and married him. We sat down to eat, and right away he said he didn't eat collards and pork was unclean. Wangaroo, though, went on through the chitlins and cornbread, the greens, and everything else. She talked a blue streak over the sweet potatoes. Everything delighted her, even the fact that we still used the benches her daddy made for the table when we couldn't afford to buy chairs. Oh, Mama, she cried, and then turned to Hakim, a barber. I never knew how lovely these benches are. You can feel the rump prints, she said, running her hands underneath her and along the bench. Then she gave a sigh, and her hand closed over Grandma Dee's butter dish. That's it, she said. I knew there was something I wanted to ask you if I could have. She jumped up from the table and went over in the corner where the churn stood, the milk in it clabber by now. She looked at the churn. She looked at it. This churn top is what I need, she said. Didn't Uncle Buddy whittle it out of a tree you all used to have? Yes, I said. Uh-huh, she said happily, and I want the dasher, too. Uncle Buddy whittle that, too? Asked the barber. D, parenthesis, Wangaroo, looked up at me. Aunt D's first husband whittled the dash, said Maggie, so low you almost couldn't hear it. His name was Henry, but they called him Stash. Maggie's brain is like an elephant's, Wangaroo said, laughing. I can use the churn top as a centerpiece for the alcove table, she said, sliding a plate over the churn. And I'll think of something artistic to do with the dasher. When she finished wrapping the dasher, the handle stuck out. I took it for a moment in my hands. You didn't even have to look close to see where hands pushing the dasher up and down to make butter had left a kind of sink in the wood. In fact, there were a lot of small sinks. You could see where thumbs and fingers had sunk into the wood. It was beautiful light yellow wood from a tree that grew in the yard where Big D and Stash had lived. After dinner, D, (Wangaroo), went to the trunk at the foot of my bed and started rifling through it. Maggie hung back in the kitchen over the dishpan. Out came Wangaroo with two quilts. They had been pieced by Grandma D and then Big D, and then Big D and me had hung them on the quilt frames on the front porch and quilted them. One was in the Lone Star pattern, the other was Walk Around the Mountain. In both of them were scraps of dresses Grandma D had worn 50 and more years ago, bits and pieces of Grandpa Gerald's paisley shirts, and one teeny faded blue piece about the piece of a penny matchbook that was from great-grandpa Ezra's uniform that he wore in the Civil War. Mama, Wangaroo said, sweet as a bird, can I have these old quilts? I heard something fall in the kitchen, and a minute later the kitchen door slammed. Why don't you take one or two of the others, I asked. These old things were just done by me and Big D from some tops your grandma pieced before she died. No, said Wangaroo, I don't want those. Those are stitched around the borders by machine. That'll make 'em last better, I said. That's not the point, said Wangaroo. These are all pieces of dresses Grandma used to wear. She did all this stitching by hand. Imagine! She held the quilts securely in her arms, stroking them. Some of the pieces, like those lavender ones, come from old clothes her mother handed down to her, I said, moving up to touch the quilts. (Wangaroo) moved back just enough so that I couldn't quite reach the quilts. They already belonged to her. Imagine, she breathed again, clutching them closely to her bosom. The truth is, I said, I promised to give them quilts to Maggie for when she marries John Thomas. She gasped like a bee had stung her. Maggie can't appreciate these quilts, she said. She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use. I reckon she would, I said. God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them. I hope she will. I didn't want to bring up how I had offered Dee, Wangaroo, a quilt when she went away to college. Then she had told me they were old-fashioned, out of style. But they're priceless, she was saying now, furiously, for she has a temper. Maggie would put them on the bed, and in 5 years they'd be in rags, less than that. She can always make some more, I said. Maggie knows how to quilt. D, Wangaroo, looked at me with hatred. You just will not understand. The point is these quilts, these quilts. Well, I said, stumped, what would you do with them? Hang them, she said, as if that was the only thing you could do with quilts. Maggie by now was standing in the door. I could almost hear the sound her feet made as they scraped over each other. She can have them, Mama, she said, like somebody used to never winning anything or having anything reserved for her. I can remember Grandma D without these quilts. I looked at her hard. She had filled her bottom lip with chuckerberry snuff, and it gave her face kind of a dopey hangdog look. It was Grandma D and Big D who taught her how to quilt herself. She stood there with her scarred hands hidden in the folds of her skirt. She looked at her sister with something like fear. But she wasn't mad at her. This was Maggie's portion. This was the way she knew God to work. When I looked at her like that, something hit me in the top of my head and ran down to the soles of my feet. Just like when I'm in church and the Spirit of God touches me and I get happy and shout. I did something I never had done before. I hugged Maggie to me and then dragged her on into the room, snatched the quilts out of Miss Wangaroo's hands, and dumped them into Maggie's lap. Maggie just sat there on my bed with her mouth open. "Take one or two of the others," I said to Dee. But she turned without a word and went out to Hakim, a barber. "You just don't understand," she said, as Maggie and I came out to the car. "What don't I understand?" I wanted to know. "Your heritage," she said. And then she turned to Maggie, kissed her, and said, "You ought to try to make something of yourself, too, Maggie. It's really a new day for us. But from the way you and Mama still live, you'd never know it." She put on some sunglasses that hid everything above the tip of her nose and her chin. Maggie smiled, maybe at the sunglasses, but a real smile, not scared. After we watched the car dust settle, I asked Maggie to bring me a dip of snuff. And then the two of us sat there just enjoying until it was time to go in the house and go to bed. There you have it. How do you feel at the end? What does that ending do for you?
Satisfied, like Maggie finally got something she deserved. Finally!
Yeah, there is some of that feeling.
There's a sense of,
I think I would have gone after the butter churn. I didn't think she deserved that either.
What was interesting about that butter churn? First of all, are there any other reactions? Did anyone have a different feeling than satisfied at the end?
Well, I guess I had some sadness too, because I don't know that she really did appreciate her heritage. She had to move away and move above it.
Dee, the daughter who moved away. Yeah.
She had to romanticize it.
It was almost like it was only of value because she could see that's where I came from, but look at me now. Type thing. I don't know, but there was. Sad. I don't think she really did see the value of her heritage, or I think her mother and sister were.
The churn and the quilt are connected, it seems, because both represent hand working. And the churn was still being used.
Right.
That's what's so amazing.
Full of clabber at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And I sort of wonder how she's going
to
finish
brazenness
it.
To take it apart. Not even to take the whole thing, but to take it apart and take the two essential parts of the churn and just take them without any sense of having deprived her mother of the possible butter waiting there. And then to take the quilts.
To say nothing about the future butter.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. And have no interest in making any herself, obviously. But then to take the quilts and likewise not perceive their use, their value in their use.
But she could have had some other quilts.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't she have those?
They didn't speak to that display of heritage in the same way. It wasn't the heritage, it was the display of it.
They were sewn around the edge with a machine.
Yeah.
Well, I know from my own family that that's verboten.
Well, she had a sensitivity about her. I mean, she talked about feeling, you know, she could feel the on the benches, the wearing by the buttocks, what were the words she used? The, I can't remember.
Mid buttocks.
Yeah, but you know, your rear end wore some rump, I think. Yeah. So yeah. So I sensed that there was a sense she was sensitive to touch, and the sewing, it was important that her grandmother had in fact hand sewn it together.
In terms of what they would fetch on the market.
Oh yes, it was worth much more.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That was my feeling, was that she has become an antique collector. It's become stylish to collect those things. And it wasn't really family, because if it had been family, her mother and her sister would have more value to her. But it wasn't that. It was the fad. It's the stylish thing to have, handcrafted things from your family.
I wondered if she was going to perhaps even sell it sometime down the road.
Yeah.
But it was a value monetarily.
But now, to give Wangaroo credit, she said, I don't want those. Those are stitched around the borders by machine. That'll make them last better, I said. That's not the point, said Wangaroo. These are all pieces of dresses Grandma used to wear. She did all this stitching by hand. Imagine. I mean, I could say the precise same thing and value them for the precise same reasons. And I'm a model human being, so.
that is very sensitive, yeah.
But you know, she remembers those old dresses, and she values the quilts partly because they have those pieces.
But it's very romantic and sentimental. Partly the thing that they weren't, that she was okay with taking something that was being used or something that her sister really needed. But it was like she could separate that and make it very romantic and I don't know what it is, symbolic. It was almost more symbolic of her family than really her family.
Mm-hmm.
She was obviously only into the objects because, you know, even though she talked about her grandmother and done that, she didn't like her name, even though she'd been named after her grandmother.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning.
But, you know, I can also appreciate when she said, well, you know, that her sister would use it and in 5 years it would be worn out. And, you know, I think about some of the things that I have that, you know, have been passed down through the family, and they're in special places that we can appreciate visually more than practically, even though we do use some of those things, but we use them guarded because once they're gone, then what, you know, the memory that they represent, the connection with my grandmother or with her parents whom I never knew will be gone.
Right.
So, you know, I can appreciate her concern that her sister would simply use them and in 5 years they would be worn out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is validity to a lot of the stuff that Wangaroo says and does, and I don't think we should necessarily make her into 100% a bad person.
Yeah, she
does. You know, she does have
I identified to her. I'm your villain. Although, and the same thing to my father. I went through her trunk. I was like, ooh, Aunt Betty did this. So I took home pieces of, I took home quilt tops and I made comforters out of them and stuff. But I didn't really care for my grandmother. But, you know, it was like, all of a sudden there was something there. And I feel like, you know, it was a little bit shallow because it was like all of a sudden these things were neat. And I can remember thinking, not liking when mother put doilies on stuff because that was so old fashioned. And now I have doilies hanging on my wall that I've starched and you know, so I've done that. I can kind of understand that.
But Wangaroo really discredited her family because her mother did not use the quilts. Her mother kept them in her trunk, at the foot of her bed, which was a special trunk at most homes, the trunk at the foot of your bed. And those quilts were important enough to her sister that she drug herself over to the door and at one point got angry. And also, her sister was the one who knew all the heritage, who made it. She remembered all that. She tried to compare that to an elephant just because she had memory. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean she just remembered things.
To me, it
meant something to her because she remembered exactly who made it and where it came from.
And she had learned from them directly. Right. She wasn't just taking something that they had done. But she had learned.
So I'm not sure Wangaroo's saying that her sister would abuse them is probably isn't necessarily true.
Mm-hmm. Just some sibling jealousy there.
Could be, yes.
She, I think the mother may have said in pique, um, you know the title of this is Everyday Use, and you know that then when that phrase shows up in the story, we pay attention. You know, the author meant us to notice this. Maggie can't appreciate these quilts, Wangaroo said. She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use. And the mother says, I reckon she would. God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them. I hope she will. And then, but exclamation point after will. So she said that emphatically. And then it says, I didn't want to bring up how I had offered D, parenthesis Wangaroo. It's important which name she puts first, I think, in the D Wangaroo thing. A quilt when she went away to college. Then she had told me they were old-fashioned, out of style. I get the sense that the mother was hurt there, hurt feelings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
That there was a little bit of, you know, very they weren't good enough for you before.
Right.
Yeah. And I hope that, you know, Maggie will use the quilts might have been sort of an overstatement, trying to be in real stark contrast to what Dee was saying.
Back in college, yeah.
Because the mother wasn't using the quilts. She was saving them, and she was going to make them a wedding gift.
Mm-hmm.
And then in another place in the story, she says, and I don't even know if these two, my other daughters, married or not. You know, married to this guy with the goat's tail beard. Or donkey tail. Donkey tail beard. So she's her daughter that she's invested in and spending time with and is going to get married is the person who's going to receive those quilts in her mind. So they have value to the mother, obviously. What's the mother like? What do we know about her? She's the narrator.
Yes.
And so you get a lot of insight into her brain because she, you can see how much she knows, how many layers of thought and feeling she'll display to us. You know what she looks like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What does she value about herself?
Her strength.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Abilities.
To work. To work like a man.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What does she think of men?
I don't remember the only comment she had was about the men protecting their animals, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. She walked a mile and a half to go.
Those men protected their animals, and she walked a mile and a half to watch them. She also describes the man that one of her daughters is going to marry as having mossy teeth and an earnest face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sounds charming. And the other man that her other daughter is with is having a donkey tail beard and being short and fat and ugly.
Well, this writer has a tendency to do that,
mm-hmm.
doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my feeling from The Color Purple, was that there was not a single positive male
attribute
that a man had.
I mean, not even, yeah, I mean, when, not only not a good guy, but not even a good male trait.
In real life, I am a large, big-boned woman with rough, man-working hands. In winter, I wear flannel nightgowns to bed and overalls during the day. I can kill and clean a hog as mercilessly as a man.
Mm.
My fat keeps me hot in zero weather. I can work outside all day.
She talked about her hands.
And another place, she says, I like doing men's work. You know, I feel, but with a real pride.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, she does describe those two particular men as being repulsive. And the father of her daughters is absent. Who knows who he may have been. But she describes those men down who work a mile and a half away with some respect.
Mm-hmm.
And she describes her own attributes
mm-hmm.
that are male with respect and pride. She does not think necessarily that the manly things that she attributes to being male about herself are bad at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think she's universal again in her sense of that. I mean, these two guys have their physical flaws, but
that's not how I interpreted her saying that stuff though.
What did you think?
I interpreted as she was laughing at the men who stayed up with their guns all night, and that she was, my interpretation of her talking about having male attributes was a so there. Huh.
Mm.
Mm.
Oh, I thought she respected the guys. That she respects strength in men.
Yeah, by all means, take these if you want to look up anything in them.
I heard the slaughtering story says more along the lines of, see, I can do it too.
Yeah.
It was a way of getting value for herself, perhaps, you know, of drawing to herself some sense of self-esteem that she did not have as a woman. I saw it almost as pathetic response to male chauvinism, that a woman would have to take that on as her sense of worth, of being able to slaughter animals so efficiently. I mean, I haven't slaughtered animals except very small ones, but I've been around farms long enough and grew up in an area where hog and cattle slaughtering was common for family use. And it's not something that one can describe, it's something that one feels. There's a feeling about her use of that imagery in the story that has a pathetic quality.
I guess I didn't look at it that way. I kind of looked at it as if, well, I've been forced into this role, male-female role, and I accept that role. She was kind of accepting of her, of life in general.
That was just one of the things she had to do. I mean, she wouldn't have said she did it for self-worth. I don't think she did it for, because that was her Latin life.
But she takes on these things and still doesn't lose her perspective of other things.
Yeah, like her dream at the beginning about being on Johnny Carson, or This Is Your Life, and Johnny Carson sort of mixed.
Yes.
And she was 100 pounds lighter and had much lighter colored skin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some quick wit.
I know a lot of Christians don't like to talk about imagery, but here's a kid. I frankly think it's one of the things that we should really be talking about in Christianity. And here she used it several cases and kind of keeps her sanity and with her imagery, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think one of the things we clearly know about this woman is that she's very smart.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, her insight into all of this stuff in terms of what she notices, what she reports to us, what she puts in juxtaposition, I think a very good mind.
And she reads her daughters. She reads her daughters very well.
And her emotion really only shows through with the stuff about getting angry about the quilt.
When you were asking what else we know about her, I got the sense during this that she loved Maggie dearly, deeply, profoundly, in a very moving way. And I didn't think that she loved Dee. I didn't hear anything ever said that made me feel that she loved that daughter.
What does she tell us about Dee? What do we know about Dee?
That's what's been bothering me. Did Dee burn the house?
That's me too.
Oh.
And is she continuing to carry with her resentment, her anger toward Dee over having destroyed their home?
I think Dee is a real
puzzle. And having scarred Maggie.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Maggie's...
It sounds like Maggie almost died.
Yeah.
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 Almost burned to death.
But I didn't get the impression that she disliked Dee. I just thought... She had to continue disciplining her.
She didn't understand her because she's so different. The mother and Maggie are a lot alike.
But I really thought the mother did understand Dee.
Mm-hmm. I found her accepting of Dee. I mean, she was her daughter. I didn't feel an animosity towards her daughter. This was reality. This is her daughter. And
did you feel love, though? I mean, I didn't sense that she hated her.
No, you know, but an acceptance, and you know, I think of mother-daughter relationships, and sometimes the kind of love one would like isn't there, but there's an acceptance because they are your, you know, because they are your child, or because they are your mother.
The worst things, what are some of the worst things she tells us about Dee? What makes us dislike Dee? On the surface, the story tells you Dee's bad and Maggie's good, or at least Dee's bad and Maggie's pathetic.
Yeah.
you know, because we're introduced to Maggie showing just enough of her thin body, enveloped in pink skirt and red blouse, for me to know she's there, almost hidden by the door. So Maggie even can't come out into the full light of day to her mother. Mm-hmm. You know, she's just sort of sandwiched behind the door. There's an interesting play on light and dark all the mm-hmm. way through this, incidentally. But so Maggie has got scarred hands that she's always hiding in the folds of her skirt, and scarred legs and scarred arms. And her eyes are were burned open, or you know, you get the sense that they're hurt by the fire. What do we know about Dee? Her eyes seem stretched open, blazed open by the flames reflected in them. And Dee, I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree she used to dig gum out of, a look of concentration on her face as she watched the last dingy gray board of the house fall in toward the hot, red-hot brick chimney. Why don't you do a dance around the ashes? I'd wanted to ask her. She had hated the house that much. I used to think she hated Maggie, too. But that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us. Us too, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with the serious way she read, to shove us away at just the moment, like dimwits we seemed about to understand. Dee wanted nice things, a yellow organdy dress to wear to her graduation from high school, black pumps to match a green suit she'd made from an old suit somebody gave me. She was determined to stare down any disaster in her efforts. Her eyelids would not flicker for minutes at a time. Often I fought off the temptation to shake her. At 16, she had a style of her own, and knew what style was.
I like that line.
You know, she was, in a way, she was a classy young lady, bright and knew that where she did not want to be, and didn't have pity on herself, but chose to go out and go for it.
A survivor. Mm-hmm.
Somewhat insensitive to her sister and mother, but
especially if she burned down the house.
But see, I don't know. See, I don't think about the burning down. I don't know. I didn't.
You didn't think about that. I did the whole time.
I wondered.
And I thought, well, that little brat, man, I would have sent Maggie to school.
What evidence did you have, though, that she burned down the house? Where do you see that?
Just from that feeling of what she said, she hated the house that much. To me, that meant she hated the house so much. She stood there intently watching what she had done happen.
I had the impression she had not been threatened at all by the fire, that she was outside safely watching the house burn, and that because Maggie had been burned so badly in the flames and her mother was rescuing her, that indeed Dee had done something to have set the fire, because she was not threatened by it.
Mm-hmm. Or well, like she was,
I guess I would have to say that there's no evidence in the story either way.
Mm-hmm. No, it is a feeling.
Just feelings. Mm-hmm.
But Dee was definitely pleased that the house burned down.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was not a tragedy to her like it was to the other.
And her emotions were focused on being pleased that the house was burned down in the face of her baby sister lying in her mother's arms, the dress falling off like
the flakes
of paper burned, you know, her arms and legs burned, her eyes burned open. Can you imagine not being moved by that? Not focusing on your sister, not worrying, wondering. I mean, that's pretty heartless. That's pretty cold.
I remember as children, my sister, who was about 2 years younger than me, being porky and klutzy. And so my parents decided that they could send one of us to dance lessons. And they sent her, not me. And I remember never understanding that. Now I understand all that. And because I was able to achieve on my own, and she needed that oomph. And I think that she sent the wrong daughter to school.
She sent the one that demanded it.
Mm-hmm. And the one that seemed to have the mind for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but she could have done it on her own. I think Dee would have learned on her own, or Maggie maybe would have gotten a gift, a free gift.
She says Maggie's not smart early on. She said, you know, quickness passed her by. But then Dee says Maggie's got a mind like an elephant. She remembers everything. So there's a little mixed evidence there. Maybe Maggie is more able to learn and remember and think and compute than her mother gives her credit for. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting mixed perception. It's interesting that the sister perceives her sister as smarter than the mother does. And the mother's one who loves that kid. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's the prodigal son demanding the birthright. And the mother, I felt like she loved them both. There was except she sat in the chair while his daughter was hopping around taking pictures of her with a Polaroid. You know,
before the daughter kissed
her. Before she's even said hello. I know, you know, it's so a little weird. Bit humbling because she's trying to get the house and the, you know, and the cow in the picture too. You know.
To me, you know, you could wrap these two children together and have your, you know, one with all of these traits. You love them for this and you kind of think they need disciplining here and
Dee had such a strong personality. When she was focusing all of her attention on that 16-year-old boy and he ran for the woods as fast as he could, got a different girl and married her just to get him safe from Dee, because Dee was so powerful. But if you had that kid of your own with that mind, I mean, she was an avaricious reader. She was so into her books and her world, and she was such a strong character, and she was such a leader among her friends, and she was determined to succeed, and she was beautiful. I mean, what more would you want in a kid? You'd want, you know, someone who couldn't stop learning and reading, and who, for whom the words were so alive that she could just flatten everybody else, you know, pull them to her, dominate, use the words to create a world for the people around her. It's a fabulous gift.
She was terribly insensitive, manipulative. She's a borderline personality.
She's a what?
Borderline personality. Somehow she didn't know how to love. It seems to me.
But she wanted to.
Chuck is saying that if you add both characteristics, that you need a Maggie in a D to make a D. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. But there was some kind of a yearning for her. I mean, she came home and there was something she was looking that she was looking for in the butter churn. But she just was a little off.
Yeah, maybe she will come back another time. Because when she gets home and finds out that she still didn't get it, she'll go back again to see if she can get it.
And she didn't get the whole butter churn. You know, it's like that was kind of the thing when she got part of it. It was like she knew there was something there. There was some kind of roots or identity or something that she wanted, but all she could do was get part of the churn. But she couldn't get the part. She couldn't get the butter and the, you know, there was something just off target. Just slightly off target. She didn't quite get fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. And she got the object that was of everyday use in the house, but she only got part of it.
Part of it.
Which and then the objects that were being saved, which are not of everyday use in that house,
she didn't get.
See, that thing had a lot of meaning to me, because I look in the cedar chest now and see an old quilt that was stitched by my grandmother or something, and I appreciate it there, but it felt so much better when it was on my bed.
Right.
So that everyday use, I remember how we used to, you know, why can't we have a new quilt or something on this bed? But I love the feel of the thing, and you recognize every piece of material in the thing. And it just isn't the same when you see it.
So it's disappearing. Yours and my great-grandmother Rushfeldt gave Grandma Beer, who gave my mother this rug that Mother gave to me that had been hand, you know, made. And I put it on the floor. And Mother came to visit
and picked it up.
And picked it up, mended it, and said I was to put it on a wall or in a closet, or she was taking it home.
Not everyday use. Whatever, put it in the bathroom floor.
And in no way did I feel that she didn't appreciate the use of this. I thought she appreciated it way more than I did. I felt like a fool. I felt like a jerk. I promised her I would never. And now it's up on the wall. But I understand what you're saying. There was something nice about having my bare feet on it.
Yeah.
You know, it was in my bedroom and made me feel all homey and stuff. It's still there. I can see it. And I'm glad this was explained to me, because it would have, in less than 5 years, ended up smithereens.
Yeah, but all these things you collect, you know.
I use mine. I have my grandmother's bowl that she made bread in, you know, and it's got a big old crack, and someday I'm going to put it in the dishwasher and it's going to... But I just feel like it's part of your heritage. I don't see... Now, some stuff I hang up, but I don't know. It sure isn't neat. You know, to have it in use. Yes. It's still part of your life. It's not something... separate or romanticized.
Well, you give up either way. You know, one way you get to use it, and you give up the object, or you don't use it, and now this will go down 5, 6, and 7 generations.
It's a museum piece, and there's no personality there.
We have a number of different pieces, like an old rocking chair without arms. Went, you know, from Pennsylvania to Kansas to Illinois, and covered wagons and all that sort of stuff in the family. And we use it. It's in our living room. We use it in creeks and everything else, but it still sits nicely. But there's a piece that's a little footstool that was hand cross-stitched. The cover was hand cross-stitched by my wife's grandmother. And our 6-year-old daughter doesn't know anything else on which to sit at the coffee table in the living room and watch Sesame Street and eat her breakfast. I mean, you know, that's what she has sat on all of her life. And it needs some work at this point.
She won't have it to give to her 6-year-old.
Yes, she will. Yeah.
There's some things you're optimistic, some that can't.
Yeah.
But it gains in its heritage. So yeah, what it loses,
all of a
gained.
Sudden it has this whole new layer of meaning and of history with it that it would not have had otherwise.
There are all kinds of these values running through the story.
But I guess I'd like to argue that Alice Walker is saying that there's value in both of those daughters.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that she is not, I mean, she first of all hands us D on a platter and says his daughter's really bad news because of the story about the fire at the beginning. But I think she pretty carefully takes us through a sympathetic view of D and says, this woman has her points too. I don't think the man with the beard is necessarily bad news. I mean, he's probably intellectual, he's probably smart enough, he's probably strong enough to handle this very dynamic, strong, intelligent woman. And he's probably a really interesting guy. You know, so what if he looks funny? All of us look funny in some way.
He has a funny name.
No. I mean, I don't think that Alice Walker is necessarily saying that he's a bad guy. The mother's impression of him at first is that he looks funny, but I mean, I think that there are lots of things about Dee that are defensible and really are quite attractive and interesting and compelling. And when Dee says to Maggie at the end, you know, you really should make something yourself, it's a different world out there. Black women can get somewhere now.
Mm-hmm.
It is a kind of a throwaway insult at her sister. She's not tuned into where her sister is. She's not bringing her sister along. But she's right. Objectively, she's not lovable. I don't get the sense that the mother loves her. But I do get the sense that Alice Walker thinks
I agree.
She's
oh,
a
I
decent
agree.
Person and an interesting person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's why we see her that way.
Yeah.
Alice Walker.
Yeah. And yeah. Alice Walker builds it into the story, like not having the mother using those quilts, saying that there's something of the mother in the daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, the mother didn't use the quilts either. Mm-hmm. You know, it isn't just in use. It isn't just in being able to make and use up quilts that value lies. But that's what Maggie can do, and Maggie's valuable too. I think all through the story, she kind of consciously says, both the new and the old, both the Maggie and the Dee, have value, and Chuck's right. It'd be nicer if they could be integrated.
Yeah, but you know darn well that I assume they're both relatively young women, and of all the people that try to beat the spunk out of you during your lifetime, you know that the D is going to mellow somewhere along the line, but you sure have to start out with a lot, particularly with a black
woman. Maggie's not going to amount to anything. She's going to marry John Thomas and have Mossy Teeth's kids.
Yeah. Have what?
Mossy Teeth's kids.
Oh, Mossy Teeth's kids.
No, they may get watch TV enough to learn about toothbrushes. But
yeah, but you know, when I know that the mother was the one that was describing Dee as having it all, but as you read that, from my own personal experience, I have four children, and the youngest of my children, in my perception, you know, is as gifted as the others, is an extremely pretty young woman, but she's the youngest of four children, and you know, she's 15, and her oldest brother is 24 and entering medical school, and her oldest sister is a mature 23-year-old woman who just graduated from college and has gone off to a wonderful job in D.C., and her 18-year-old brother is, you know, they all were involved in athletics, and she looks at them, and they've all arrived. They've all done it so well, and she feels like a total, you know, like she can't do it. She feels real, she feels like the way the mother describes her other daughter, you know, her own self-image is she struggles with constantly. And I have to remind her that they're 24 and 23 and 18, and she's only 15. And when they were 15, you know, they were where she is today. But, you know, so I got caught up in that emotion of this perfect daughter, because that's how my daughter perceives her siblings, as these perfectly together, having it all type thing, and she wanting to be where they are and not, but it's the age difference. So I got all caught up in that. Mm-hmm. From just my own personal perspective.